Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru. And welcome to Yogananda Podcast, where we talk everything Yogananda. And we're on Autobiography of a Yogi, line by line, starting a new chapter. And we're down one amigo today. Lauren is not with us, but we have the Musketeers, the three Musketeers here. So we'll continue nonetheless. And Lauren will join us again for the next episode.
Wouldn't a female be an amiga or something?
Yeah, amiga, it would be. It would be.
Oh, wow, yeah. I'm impressed with myself.
Chris is half Portuguese, basically.
Yeah. You're actually more bilingual, Frank, aren't you? You're multilingual, Indian.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, yes, we have one amiga down. So we're kicking off this chapter. It is a rather significant and maybe reflective of that significance long chapter. So we're going to do our best, really break it up into reasonable bite sizes for us all to digest. But in total, it's 27 pages long, probably the longest chapter in the book. And the chapter's title is Years of My Master's Hermitage. So it is a really, I suppose, a pivotal point in Yogananda's life. Right up to this point in the book, we've really observed Yogananda struggling to find his guru, trying to skip to the Himalayas, and his childhood is now quite well and truly behind him. The last chapter, we saw that he was even getting devotees, right? And I did share with you guys a link the other day that we talked about it in the podcast. Was it the first devotee or was it not the first devotee that he obtained, let's say, in the previous chapter? And it turned out it's probably not the first devotee, right? Because the very lovable brother Ananda.
Pratap, you're talking about, right?
Pratap, from a Pratap. Yes.
That devotee in Vrindavan.
Pratap Chatterjee, yes.
Yes, exactly. Well, Brother Anandamoy, in a video I was watching for the purposes of this chapter, mentioned that Guruji, even before he met Sri Yukteswar, was on devotees. And his story, we're going to talk about this video later on, so we'll link it in the description. You can check it out yourself. And the story goes that Yogananda, as a young boy in school, rather playfully sort of nudged a schoolmate and, you know, thrusted a bit of paper into his hands, and on that paper said, you know, I'm your guru, to this random schoolboy. I think it turned out indeed to be true. So even in school days, Yogananda, you know, young Mukunda was indeed, fulfilling his place as a guru.
Maybe that was you in a past life, Chris.
You know, before, haven't we? And you know, it'd be fun to think, but also obviously this is the second shot I think of following the career process, so no pressure.
Minimum second. It's a long, I've have had a long horse.
You're on your multiples, are you? Multiple shots. Yeah, maybe we've all met Guruji in past lives before, you say, right? So quite possibly any one of us could have been that little boy in school with young Kinder getting the piece of paper saying, I am your guru. What a surprise that would be. But this is a turning point. Yogananda is really going to be stuck into the life in the hermitage, and we're going to go into this in great detail. And my initial take on this is actually it's much, much more detailed than what I thought we were initially going to get, really. Given that Yogananda's style of writing, you might say, in his life is to be giving us the kind of hot topics and kind of captivating stories, and this is no less captivating, but it is going into the more minute details on the day-to-day life, and we can talk about maybe why that is. But my expectations really for this chapter going into it was I didn't recall that it was anywhere near as long as what it is or anywhere near as detailed as what it was, but it definitely gives you a real picture as to exactly what it was like living under the guidance of Sri Yukteswar at the time, and the reality of life for Yogananda, our guru, and what really made him into the guru that we know today. So really keen to get stuck into it. But guys, I'll come to you, Mike. What's your take on the expectations?
It's a bit similar to what you said. I was surprised how much detail Guruji goes into in this chapter, how he describes the building, he describes Sri Yukteswar. A lot of the dialogue he has with Sri Yukteswar is in this chapter. But then we shouldn't forget that he spends about 10 years there in this ashram. So this is a really big portion of his life and a really significant one. I think when he enters and when he leaves, he's like a completely different person.
Well, that's a good point, 10 years. So it's only 2.7 pages per year. So think about it in that context. It's just really too short, isn't it? Considering the book is over 500 pages long, the print I've got anyway. my takeaway was that there was going to be lots and lots of lessons, but in a very easily digestible format, i.e. with real life examples, as opposed to lots and lots of lessons, for example, in God Talks with Arjuna or the Second Coming, or you know, the lessons. Those are you know, monumental works that require lots of studious effort and, you know, note taking and all that kind of stuff. But this is just nice narrative between guru and disciple. So, you know, everything in terms of how to live is in here, isn't it? He talks from things like diet and how to kill your fear of mosquitoes, to how a master deals with his peers, and which you know, who he gives respect to and who he doesn't, all that kind of stuff. But I'm most interested, I must say, in Guruji, in digging deeper into those things, but particularly into digging deeper into how an enlightened master, i.e. Yogananda, describes another enlightened master and their interactions. Because Yogananda can't really talk about himself, because, you know, as an enlightened master, really, can he? Because you have to be like, you know, it's not really very well received, especially in the Western audience, when you talk about the greatness of yourself. But he can really go to town on the greatness of another, i.e. Sri Yukteswar and his guru. So I'm really looking forward to how he describes another master such as himself, obviously. But really, this is just a précis into how a guru is made, as Chris kind of alluded to. So this is essential reading for us.
Yeah, and we had a bit of an inclination with how this chapter might start from the previous chapter, where in the previous chapter, we'll remember that Sri Yukteswar and Guruji had a bit of a disagreement exactly as to how their relationship should kick off. And Sri Yukteswar essentially told young Mukunda, you know, return home. And at the time, that was not to young Mukunda's liking. And Sri Yukteswar warned him to say, look, the next time we meet, I might not welcome you as openly, or not as openly. What was the exact quote? Sorry, guys, save me here. He wouldn't take him in as readily, as quickly, essentially.
Yeah. Won't be so easy next time.
Won't be so easy, yeah.
I'm paraphrasing.
That's it, paraphrasing, thanks. That is literally how it starts, right? So you have come is the first line in this chapter. And it's Sri Yukteswar greeting Mukunda from a tiger skin on the floor. And the description that Yogananda gives us is that his voice was cold and the manner was unemotional. So that's how it starts. And it's interesting, actually, that this was not what I expected reading and being so uplifted from the whole book to date, essentially, through the drama and everything. I was expecting it to be one big party, you know?
Homecoming.
So it's one big homecoming, yeah. So I was actually quite surprised, even though we did get that warning in the previous chapter, Frank.
Yeah, from my you know, I'm a reader at the London Centre, and they give you these instructions on how to be a good reader. And they place a lot of emphasis on you trying to understand what Guruji has written and where to place the emphasis on which word of the sentence to make sure that the audience can understand it. Now, these three words, "you have come," if you put the emphasis on either of those words, the whole meaning changes completely. I'll give you an example. Chris, "you have come," or "you have come," or "you have come." There's three different, completely different takes, isn't there? And and because it says his voice was cold, you can imagine it was "you have come," you know, accusatory. "You weren't, you know, after disobeying me," essentially, and you're saying it's unemotional. So it's pretty surprising, as Chris says, you know, I expected a homecoming as well from the meeting after Lifetimes. But this is quite a scary, scary greeting, isn't it? This is what etches the fear factor of Sriyadesha into my mind. And Mike obviously ignores these. It's Mike is of the third, "you have come," you know, the pleasant version.
I thought it would be worse than that, because maybe it's because I'm German and we are very literal about what we say. But he said you will come in 4 weeks, and he said never, right? That was his answer. So I would have thought he would have said, "Didn't you say you're not coming? What are you doing here now?" So he didn't.
Yeah.
It's somehow, but he went anyways. If I would have said the things that Mukunda said, I would have then thought, can I really go there now? I told him I'm never coming. I guess this was just words, and they don't take them too seriously.
Yeah, in this case, I think definitely emotions were running high, even for our master at the time, Mukunda. And I think it was the words were that he wouldn't be accepted so easily, that he wouldn't accept him so easily. That's what Sriyadesha said. And so he doesn't really. So I took it as monotone. "You have come." No emphasis on any words. It's almost worse.
Oh yeah, that's a fourth option.
The fourth option.
Forgot that one.
No emphasis.
No emphasis.
And so here we have actually quite an understanding, Mukunda, I would say, in the following discourse, that Mukunda says, you know, "Yes, dear master, I'm here to follow you." So he just clears out all the prior, you know, discourse of issues rebellious tone that he had, and he essentially bows mentally to Sri Yukteswar Priyank.
Probably physically bows to him. He says, "Kneeling, I touch his feet." But he says, "I'm here to follow you." And now it's a bit confusing, this line, for me, because I'd expect him to say, "I'm here to follow instruction from you. I'm here to follow your every, you know, wish for my spiritual progress," all that kind of stuff. But he says, "I'm here to follow you," because it's not a literal, he doesn't actually want to physically go follow him around, does he? But I think later on in this section, he says, "You know best," you know, Guruji tells Sri Yukteswar, "You know best," and, you know, agrees to everything that he wants, even though he doesn't want to do those things. So I think we can safely assure that that implies that "I'm here to follow anything that you teach me, and I'm going to be loyal and obedient."
Yeah, you're right. Does follow on to say, "Kneeling, I touched his feet." And so I imagine the mood was still cold, right? So it's not like Sri Yukteswar suddenly then turned around and, you know, embraced him. He does say, "How can that be? You ignore my wishes." And Mukunda's saying that, you know, this isn't going to happen any longer. And he says a beautiful line. He says, "Your wish shall be my law." And I thought that was a fantastic line. That had such meaning behind it. And indeed, Sri Yukteswar responds very positively, doesn't he, Priyank?
Yes, he does. But, you know, his initial, obviously, he didn't show any positive feeling at the first words and first greeting. Would you two have dared going down near him and touching his feet at that point, lest he like do something like move backwards or, you know, add do something strange? I would have been pretty fearful. But I think this just reveals how scared I am of Sri Yukteswar. Because I remember once I actually did do this, but there was once a saint, a female saint that I was seeking darshan from. And I went, I'd done something that she wasn't happy with. This is when I was 18. And, but I still touched her feet. And and she still did pretty much what Sri Yukteswar did. I told me off, but allowed me to touch her feet. So that was positive.
Yeah, I mean the whole scene is very efficient conversation, I found, because they are from a complete disagreement into an agreement in four lines of dialogue. But I think in order to be so efficient, you need to use those strong kind of words, like "your wish shall be my law." It says everything. That it completely satisfies Sri Yukteswar's conditions, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, I am here to follow you. You ignore my wishes. Your wish shall be my law. Yeah. And then, you know, he finishes off this interaction really with Sri Yukteswar, saying that now I can assume responsibility for your life. And that, again, is, like you said, like there's so much weight behind these words, and there's so few words to say. It's so efficient. And it's such a beautiful kind of quick turnaround, isn't it, from such a cold initial reception. But Sri Yukteswar is hearing what he essentially needs to hear from Mukunda in order to accept him, Priyank.
Yeah, because this is obviously words, music to Mukunda's ears, right? And the previous meeting obviously ended in quite a bad note because he refused to go back to his family home. So this is like 180 degrees flip from Mukunda, and he's rewarded by that, by this beautiful, you know, beautiful words of Sri Yukteswar. Like, I can now assume responsibility for your life. You know, these are epic words to hear, isn't it, from for us? Because if someone, you know, if a master said that to you, then hey, your worries are over, right? Your incarnation's fulfillment is fulfilled, really.
Do you think this those kind of vocabulary is the same when he joined Dayananda's ashram, or was that different? And then the second thing I thought is, what if Chichendra would have come along? Would he have been also so open to Sri Yukteswar and just say, "You are my guru, you take responsibility for my life"?
You know, the thought that just occurred to me that later on we're going to talk about Maya and this play that we're witnessing. You know, Guruji is living his life as an avatar for us, and, you know, he's sharing these stories for us, right? And we don't have, what occurred to me is we don't have Guruji in the physical form to go up and, you know, have disagreements with in person, and, you know, have, you know, lovely words exchanged between each other and hear these words coming from him to say that I assume responsibility for your life. We don't have that. But he is telling us this exchange between himself and his gurus that we can materialize that, you know, within our own relationship and our personal relationships with our master, with Guruji himself, right? So we can actually copycat this to some degree, that, you know, your wish shall be my law. It's beautiful, actually, isn't it? So that's a lovely moment that we're getting this insight to, so that we can indeed copy it. And it probably meant a lot to Mukunda, right? And Mukunda goes on to want to hear certain words from Sri Yukteswar about how he loves him. So Sri Yukteswar really is a man of few words. So I'm sure he cherished this moment for a long time. So Mukunda then, you know, acknowledges this moment and says, "I willingly transfer the burden." And I just thought that was a great another great line, and it does speak to the whole journey that they're going to go on, and the description that Yogananda says about the teaching that Sri Tushar gives him. It's like pulling teeth, you know, it's quite hard on the ego. So this is the burden that Sri Tushar is taking on, but he's doing it willingly. Both of them are doing it willingly, Mike.
Yeah, because we talked about this earlier, that actually assuming responsibility for a disciple is a burden and not a, like, instinctively first you might think, oh, now I have someone who does everything I want them to do, so this is actually a boon or power, but it's actually a burden because you are responsible for him finding God now, and that is a huge responsibility.
Spoiler alert. In finding God, but we'll certainly get to that in the next part of this part of the chapter. And so Yogananda then says that he's going to transfer the burden. Sri Yukteswar immediately comes back to say that his first request is for him again to return to the family and enter university college in Calcutta, and that the education should be continued. And this is going to be music to not Mukunda's ears, but his father's ears instead, this line. And Yogananda, having learned from the previous interaction, does not put up any restraint and says, very well, sir, and that he hid his consternation. This is an interesting part because he says that a line here that would inopportune books pursue him down the years. You know, he's trying to get away from schooling, from education, and pursue more, you know, meditation. And we can talk about this in a little bit more detail. And he says, first father in Sri Yukteswar. So he's transferring this blame of responsibility onto the father and Sri Yukteswar, Priyank.
Is the word importunate? Importune is the word that which means you know, when something harasses you or consistent doesn't leave you alone, or things, something essentially that you don't want is bothering you. So this is I think it's an important word, this importune, because later on, and if we look, you know, Mukunda, Paramahansa Yogananda is obviously somewhat of a scholar, you might say, with his commentary on the, you know, the holiest scriptures of the East and the West, and, you know, his writings are amongst the most respected commentaries out there, even for non-devotees. But so some books he definitely did want and did like later on in his years, probably even back then, because we know he, you know, established libraries, spiritual libraries and things, even when he was, you know, younger than this, 18 years of age, which you would have been there. So it's just that he wasn't averse to study, in a sense. It was that the books that fill the halls of academic, you know, conventional academic institutions, and, you know, we mentioned, yes, last time, past paper engineering and learning things just for the sake of learning, just because you got to pass the exam, and all these things, I'm sure he would have. This is what he's averse to, right? Because he's not averse to books. It's just the specific types of books and specific types of study. And it's really funny, isn't it? This, he had his consternation, and, you know, these things that are going to pursue him for all the years. First his dad, now Sri Yukteswar.
He's also still quite young, so it's understandable. And I think over the course of his life, he read probably more books than most people have. So. Mm-hmm. I think he was very, very much someone who was very scholarly when it came to research, and he read a lot of books just to know what they are about. But I do understand that here at this point, he doesn't see the purpose of the whole thing. He doesn't think he's this whole talk about the West, that also, I think Lahiri Mahashaya once said, right? This was an idea, but void of meaning. So it yet had to mean something to him. So for him, it was just, why learn, like Priyank said, why learn something when it doesn't help me in later life?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Good points. Well raised, gents, on this. If it was maybe a spiritual school, or something, that he could go and study, you know, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, and he would be there more willingly than studying engineering or IT or something at the time. HR, what are you going to say?
No, what did you study? I forgot.
I studied environmental management and economics. Okay.
That sounds like more useful.
Yeah, it's not my day job, put it that way. So yeah, maybe that's the strife that young Gundas is going through. Is it going to be applicable to his life? Well, he couldn't see it. However, this really is maybe just obscured to him at the time. He couldn't see what Sri Yukteswar could see very clearly. And that was, as Sri Yukteswar goes on to say, that someday you will go to the West. And maybe there's the emphasis on will, Priyank. We don't know, but I'm going to put it there. And that Sri Yukteswar describes it as being more important to have a degree in the West, because they'll be more receptive to India's ancient wisdom, if a strange Hindu teacher has a university degree. And it's a very practical kind of point here in the relationship, isn't it? That, yeah, it's kind of necessary to do this in this world of Maya for people to pay attention, right, Mike?
Did you guys find this in your own lives, that the title that you got helped you get heard or open certain doors that would have otherwise been closed?
Yes, mm-hmm. I did. But I'm over the moon that times have now changed. Not having a university education is now not necessarily seen as a negative as it was back in, you know, when I started my career, which you had to have a degree, you know, in a relevant field from a respectable establishment, all that kind of stuff that was there, you know, ever since Mukunda, so in Sri Yukteswar, you know, I'm sure Sri Yukteswar didn't really want him to go to university. It's just that he knew that you needed a piece of paper to be taken seriously, Mukunda, that is, and we had to do that. But now times have changed, right? Ascending Dwapara is at the stage where education now is not graded on what piece of paper you hold, but actually how well you can perform in an interview, right? That's more important than what letters you have next to your name. And I think that's such a good sign of the growth of civilization, isn't it, and the maturity of civilization, where experience now is held in higher esteem than what you've slavishly book learned to get a degree.
I think the UK is also particularly liberal here compared to other countries. Like in Austria, for example, when we have a master's degree, we put that in our passport, on our insurance card, and you know, when you're in the hospital, it says your title first and then your name when you're lying in the hospital bed or something, you know, and then they come to you. So master translates in German into Magister. Mm. And that is a title that is being used often. So if anyone has done a master's degree, they would come over to you in an office environment that is a bit old school, but still exists. They would say, "Hey, Magister Patel, how are you doing today?" Because that's just, but it's probably going away from there, I guess. You're right, the Dwapara Yuga is working differently.
So you're saying some people are in different ages depending on which part of the world they're living in.
Depends on the industry. Like if you work for the government, there it's still very strong that you hear all of those. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because when I was I've been a hiring manager a few times, and now you know, I've had people in my teams that have had, you know, really good education, and I've had people that have had nil education but really good experience, which one do you think is of more use to me?
Of course.
So
yeah.
So you know, when I go to various schools and advise some young engineers out there, I tell them, you know, you don't need to necessarily go and go to the best university and go do the hardest degree and forget about all of that 3 years later. If you can work out a path that gets you to this level of experience, which is what I'm looking for, then it doesn't matter whether or not you've got a degree, you're going to get the same salary as that guy who spent $100,000 on this so-called university education and spent 4 or 5 years of his life. But yeah, Mike.
Yeah, I would agree. But then you need that experience. So if you have neither the experience nor the degree,
then you're finished.
So and when I look at when CVs come in for hiring, those people who have no degree but good experience, they're rare. They're not not the norm. But of course, if they exist, then there's no reason not to hire them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but wouldn't it be the case though, right? Back in like just a decade ago, you'd throw that piece of paper away, wouldn't you? If they didn't have a degree.
Filtered out. Yeah.
Yeah, it's my day-to-day struggle as a recruiter trying to find the best person for the role as opposed to the most technically qualified.
Mm.
It is an evolving picture, evolving landscape, right? Very interesting. And Guruji is really challenging, you know, why do I need to do this? And there Sri Yukteswar kind of hits him with this, you know, prophecy, right? And it's quite a, you know, a moment that's just passed by. You know, he already has this, not planned, but he envisages exactly how young Mukunda's life is going to unfold. And interestingly, we don't see any dialogue between the two of them to say, hold on, what do you mean? I'm going to go to the West from Mukunda. He simply says, you know best, Guruji. And somewhat comically says, my gloom parted. And so he exited. He mentions here that the reference to the West that he found puzzling, remote, but his opportunity to please the master by obedience was vitally immediate. So he didn't want to even stop and say, hey, you know, hang on, can I ask a question? He just said, yes, Guruji.
I don't really understand, perhaps you can help me, the context of my gloom departed here, because he's essentially been told about you're going to the West, you know, and you're going to go to university, etc. And Mukunda then just obediently says, you know, best. And then he says, my gloom departed, because I'd expect him to say my gloom departed, for example, when he says, I can assume responsibility for your life, Sukadeshwar says, then I can expect him to say my gloom departed. And then he says, I willingly transfer the burden, master. But here he's responding to the prophecy. So I'm a bit puzzled. Perhaps could it be that he was puzzled by this prophecy and hence his gloom departed for puzzlement? I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think Mukunda, he really cares about doing this degree because he knows this degree is a lot of work, not doing this in vain. He's doing this degree for his guru, and his guru is not telling him to do this for his dad's sake or something like that, or because it's tradition or because it looks good, but because he has a plan for Mukunda, and part of this plan is him having this degree. So I guess in that sense, it suddenly turns into a challenge for the quest that he has to serve his guru and on his spiritual path. So maybe that's why it became lighter for him.
So do you think he's joyful then that his having to go to university for an actual higher cause?
I think he's I agree with what Chris said. Yeah,
he has went from describing himself not saying anything. He didn't want to actually say to Sri Yukteswar about his consternation. He hid his consternation. So whatever that moment was that he was having about, you know, not wanting to go back and do the education, that's gone because he's heard sufficiently, you know, that he should be falling in behind, as he said, and follow the lead of his master. So I think he's just snapped back to where he was at the beginning of the conversation when he said, I'm here to follow you, you know, your wish shall be my law. And then he snaps back to that mindset.
You know, Sri Yukteswar says, you'll go to the West, you know, and then hints at it by saying, hints at its purpose for going to the West, because he says, its people will be more receptive to India's ancient wisdom if the strange Hindu teacher has a university degree. So he's kind of all saying that you're going to be a Hindu teacher and you're going to share India's ancient wisdom, which is obviously beautiful music to Guruji's ears. But imagine Sri Yukteswar had said, you're going to go to the West and you're going to be a VP of GM, you know, the most important company. Do you think then his gloom would have been even worse?
Yeah.
I don't know how to answer this, but yes, probably. But I found it interesting how little he cared about the West. He said it was remote and he didn't know what it really meant, but he did not inquire further. And this probably means that he completely trusts Sri Yukteswar with his plan, wants to please his guru, but also that by himself, he would have never come up with that idea. So that is not something that played a role in his mind.
I really like that he says, the opportunity to please master by obedience was vitally immediate. Because he's obviously has not pleased him in the first meeting. And so now he has to really pull out all the stops.
Yeah. For me, this comes under the topic of loyalty, and Guruji's talked a lot about that. It's extremely important on our path that we're all following. And I found on the YSS website a video that we can play a couple of minutes on this topic, because I just think it's quite an uplifting one to remind ourselves of what Guruji is essentially putting into practice here, about loyalty being the highest law for spiritual success. And it is a talk by Swami Ishtananda. And I'll just prelude it by saying that we'll play 7 minutes into it and play a couple of minutes of the talk. And it's a much longer talk. We'll put the link in the description if anybody else wants to listen to the whole thing. I'd recommend it. It's very good. But essentially, Swami Ishtananda's retelling a story that the day before Master left his body, that there was a new monk in the ashram, and that the monk later became known as Brother Mokshananda. And one of the few things the Master said to this young monk was, loyalty is the highest law. So we'll follow on from that point in the story, and we'll play a couple of minutes now of Swami Ishtananda.
And that's our topic this morning, loyalty, highest law of spiritual success. And this was something, a quality that Master really stressed. And the reason was he saw it was so little understood. And if you think about how often loyalty comes up in our SRF path, those of us who have taken the Kriya Yoga initiation, we vow a loyalty to our guru, our line of gurus, and to the organization our guru founded. And in the Christian monastic orders, they take vows of celibacy, obedience, and what they call poverty. In the SRF monastic order, we take the vow of obedience and chastity. Instead of poverty, we take what's called a vow of simplicity. Master didn't like the term poverty. He said it intimates a lack, and that God's devotees knows no lack. But in addition to those three vows for the monastic order in SRF, he added the vow of loyalty. And many of you have joined the Voluntary League of Disciples, and in that pledge that you take, is a pledge of loyalty. And in the SRF marriage vows, it says, we will be loyal to each other to show our capacity for divine loyalty. So we can see how much emphasis that Master placed on loyalty. And for success on the spiritual path, we're going to have to be loyal to something other than to our ego. And that's where most of our loyalty lies. But success on the spiritual path is going to depend on loyalty to something else. And this is one of the reasons Brother Bhaktananda used to say, loyalty is a universal law. Loyalty is a universal law. It's a universal law if we're going to move beyond the confines of that very constricting consciousness of the ego.
Yeah. So yeah, great talk there. Highly recommend listening to the whole thing if you do have the time. On loyalty, and Yogananda is essentially saying that his gloom departed whenever he fell into sync with his guru, right? He was receiving the blessings of his guru immediately. So whatever that, he was having loyalty to his ego, and that was overcome immediately by saying to the guru, yeah, you know, I'll whatever you say, sir. So if that can work for him, I will definitely take that into my own life as well. And so Sri Yukteswar says, moving on, he says, you'll be near Calcutta. And Yogananda responds to say, you know, I'm going to come to you every day, you know, if possible. And Sri Yukteswar, you know, he did indeed welcome Mukunda to come whenever you find time. So Mukunda saying, yeah, I'll be able to find time more than what you might think. And so he gratefully accepted Sri Yukteswar's authority in every day, in every detail of his life. But he did ask for one condition upon this. And he said that you must reveal God to me. Now this is, we can jump into it, Priyanka, I'll come to you first, but it seems like quite a simplistic request, quite a simplistic condition, or maybe one that you might expect of your guru, but there's a very long, it's a 1 hour long verbal tussle ensued. So we're going to get into it in a second. Priyanka, I'll come to you first.
Do you not think it's pretty audacious to say to your guru, I'll do what you say on one condition? And I think it's the kind, I don't think either of us would have the cojones to say such a thing to your master. But a master can say that to a master, right? So it's an avatar speaking to an avatar. And hence this condition actually has credence, and it's treated with respect, because I imagine if I was young Jitendra, you know, going back to Mike's point, how would he have approached this Sri Yukteswar? If he had said, you know, Sri Yukteswar, I really like your ashram, but I'll join the ashram on one condition. You can pretty much imagine what Sri Yukteswar would have thought of that. He would not have said, yes, question mark. He would be like, turn around and walk back upstairs and close the door behind him, I imagine. But Mukunda asking him that, he's actually entertaining it. And, you know, as Chris says, he says that you promised to reveal God to me. I was wondering what would you guys say? So like, say Sri Yukteswar had granted your one condition, how would you have phrased this? Because I think we all would probably, well, I hope none of us ask for like a BMW or something, but we would ask for God, essentially God realization. But how would you phrase it? Because I wouldn't have said, you promise to reveal God to me. And obviously this is in Bengali, so this is a translation. So it's difficult to get to the sentiment from the original tongue. But I would have said something about Nirvi Kalpa Samadhi, maybe, you know, bestow that divine experience. You know, it's essentially the same thing, right? But I don't, how would you guys have, what would you have guys have said? What words would you have used?
I this caught me off guard a little bit when I read this, because I kind of took this for, this is the whole reason why you look for a guru. So it comes without saying that I'm looking for God and I'm here for you to reveal him to me. But I think the reason why Guruji put this in this book is because he kind of makes a big deal out of it that it really is. And when we follow Guruji and we take the vows to do Kriya Yoga, then we kind of go on this path, and we are also, I mean, we, I think if we were disciples but God was never revealed to us, then this would be difficult. So the real reason why we're on this path is to find God eventually. And I don't think that's a very audacious thing to say at the end of the day. That's really the reason why he's here. And he doesn't say you will reveal him to me in 1 month or in this lifetime or anything like that. He just eventually. And so it is a really big deal, but it's also kind of what the guru-disciple relationship, that's the other part of it, right?
I think it's the thing that caught me on guard is because your love for your guru is unconditional. So putting a condition on it is a strange one. But I think Mukunda, when he says promise to reveal God to me, I think he must be saying in this lifetime, although he hasn't written it here, because we're all obviously going to go back to God at some point. And if we don't make it in this life, Guruji's promise to us, you know, if we're sincere and in our efforts, that he will, in the end, we'll get there, right? But not necessarily in this lifetime. We don't know how many lifetimes it takes. But I think he's definitely saying, essentially, now. I want it now, not in your lifetimes away. What do you think? What would you, Chris, said if you had the opportunity to ask Rukdeshwar for one thing or one condition?
Well, I'm just going to note that Mike didn't answer your question.
I stand by that. Yeah.
Very, very stealthy. Very stealthy on Mike's part. You know, I agree with everything you guys are saying. Actually, whilst my initial take was, it's a given. You know, this is something that you assume in a sense. So you go to a guru for this purpose. So why is Guruji saying it? It does stand out to me. And I think the only thing that I can say is that it's the second time that I can make the same comment on this episode, is that it's for our benefit. It isn't actually for, you know, Guruji's benefit, because he knows Sri Yukteswar. We've already covered that in previous chapters. He knows that Sri Yukteswar is God realized. So I think this is essentially, and we're going to go into this in a little bit more detail here, about this hour-long verbal tussle is more simply for the reader. Say, hey guys, you know, be mindful that there are plenty of gurus out there. You know, if you're not attuned, you might not know if they're God realized or not, and so on and so forth. And this is the purpose of a guru. And that's just Yogananda, in a sense, enforcing that. So I'm not going to answer your question either, Prem, because I don't have an answer for it. that's what I'll say.
This book is also a spiritual reference for a lot of people who might not end up on this path, but they might learn something from it. And then if you find another guru, like Chris just said, this is a really legitimate question to ask. Will you reveal God to me? Because that's kind of what I'm looking for. So this is an essential part of the guru-disciple relationship. And he's, like Chris said, it's for the reader. It's just to know what's actually going on. It might not happen with a lot of people finding their master so outspokenly, but it's kind of understood.
The hour-long verbal tussle, I think, could also be a clue to Guruji's teachings, where he asks us to actually talk with God. So we can have this verbal tussle with God in our, or after meditation, or even, you know, when we have that period of silence after meditation, And we can, I'm sure we'll get a response if we keep asking the question, and little dribs and drabs of divine guidance appear here and there, and we keep asking, then I'm sure we'll get the answer. But not many of us are that persistent as Guruji is in this case, for example, and we know how persistent he is with his pursuit of God and Divine Mother in this life.
What was interesting about this dialogue is that Sri Yukteswar doesn't turn around and say yes immediately either, does he? It's an hour long verbal tussle. So he doesn't say, even after accepting the responsibility for his life and Guruji submitting to his direction, he doesn't guarantee that you're going to have God revealed to you through me. And I can only assume that this is essentially to test the steel of Yogananda's conviction, to see if he's going to be steadfast on this mission, because it's going to be a hard, tough path, and he's going to have to overcome many obstacles. So I think essentially that's what I came to, is that this 1 hour long conversation that they had was to test the will of Yogananda at the time, and that's essentially what I'm taking as a learning from it. Priyank?
I wish he'd written an addenda for advanced disciples to the autobiography where he's detailed what this hour-long verbal tussle, line by line, entailed. Because we would, I'm sure, delight in reading that, wouldn't we? Especially for this podcast.
It gives us some glimpse, right? And he says that, Master's word cannot be falsified, cannot be lightly given. Implications in the pledge open up. This is a beautiful line. Open out vast metaphysical vistas, and the guru must be on an intimate term with the creator, and that before he can oblige him to appear. So I suppose along those lines, we could assume to some degree that that's how the conversation would have went. He recognizes here that he sensed Sri Yukteswar's divine unity and was determined as a disciple to press it at his advantage. So he really pressed Sri Yukteswar in this, which, to be honest, I'm not surprised at all. Mukunda was always one to press it at his advantage to the benefit of his spiritual development. Frank.
I absolutely love this paragraph. As you mentioned, he said the master's word cannot be falsified, it is not lightly given. So the first part of that is really about how the guru holds fast and adheres to truth, especially when he's made promise, for example, or has said certain things are going to be this way, then he won't essentially go against that. So I love that element of that, the eternal promise, which you kind of discussed about in the last episode as well. That's in the lessons as well. And also, I love the metaphysical vistas. And I was thinking what, because we know obviously how this story unfolds. And I was wondering which bits of his interactions with Sri Yukteswar he could be referring to. And I thought of two in particular, his experience in cosmic consciousness. That's one colossal vista that he had available to him. And also Mukunda's, and also when Sri Yukteswar had his resurrection and came back to Mukunda or Yogananda back then, Swami Yogananda as he was. Oh, he was a Paramahansa Yogananda actually at that time, and obviously revealed the three worlds essentially, and delved into the detail of, well, actually every facet of the cosmos. And we're obviously gonna, don't know how many episodes that chapter is going to take, but we're going to go into that. But those are the two metaphysical vistas I was thinking about.
When I thought of the way he raised the question, like, will you reveal God to me? I found that this is an interesting thing because it takes the effort of the guru, but also of the disciple, right? So you cannot just give this promise and then have a disciple who is not willing to do all the work for it. So I'm also guessing they might have talked about that during the discussion. They're like, you will have to do this and this and then in the end when the promise is given, it's a very interesting sentence the way he gives the promise, right? He doesn't say yes, he says a sentence that has a lot of meaning as well, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think these two words, metaphysical vistas, when I read it, my mind just kind of melted a little bit when I thought, wow, like metaphysical vistas opens up metaphysical vistas. What did it mean? And along the lines that you said, Priyanka, I think this is indeed trying to comprehend the vastness of the reality of which we live and our part within it, and then therefore the relationship with the guru. What does that actually mean within this context? I did see a really good video again. We can link it to the in the descriptions. You know, listeners, you'll have plenty of SRF content to consume in the coming days and weeks. It's the guru, the Guide to Eternal Freedom talk by Swami Anilananda Giri. And in summary, the beginnings of the video kind of talk to this topic of metaphysical vistas, where Swami Anilananda says that essentially we have, you know, four options in life. And one is to keep on reincarnating on Earth. And the second one's reincarnating on the astral plane. And then third is reincarnating or going to the causal, joining there for an untold time. Or fourth is final, you know, oneness with God. And, you know, he's talking to a vast audience and he's getting the audience to put their hands up for which ones they want. And of course, nobody puts their hand up for the first one. And a couple put their hands up for the second. They're like, yeah, no, I'd take that over. You know, reincarnating on Earth and so on. But it was a nice exercise, and he followed it up with a mental exercise to say, envisage the universe, the sun times 10 with planets times 10, the sun times 100 with all the planets, times 100,000, you know, times a million, times a billion, and 100 billion with all the planets and moons and everything that comes with it. And that's just our galaxy. And then we'll have hundreds of billions of galaxies. And that's just our universe that we know of. And Yogananda talks about, you know, plural universes. So, and that's the physical realm. So beyond that, it's this ceaseless cycle of time that Swami Anilananda talks about, that, quoting from the slok is the Mahabharata, the eternal processes and yugas and things like this. So when we think about this metaphysical vista that we're just a small part of, it is pretty, you know, pretty impressive. And then there within it is this promise that we have from the guru that goes into eternity. It is something that fills me with gratitude when I think I can't even comprehend this physical universe, let alone everything beyond it. Priyank?
Yeah. Also, going back to the point about you know, the condition, you know, Master places a condition on Sriyukdesha, and now he doubles down on that, and he says he senses Sriyukdesha's divine unity and was determined as his disciple to press his advantage. And I really find this surprising to read, because it's just unheard of to I think it's maybe because from my background, it is unheard of to say these things about a guru, let alone like someone who is of a position of, you know, that you have to respect, are you like a parent or older sibling or something. You just can't do this stuff. It's like, it's always like complete obedience. It's never what's my ulterior, you know, what's the motive, you know, there's supposed to be none of that, but he's being so like just openly honest about his intentions. It's just really cool to read. But I suppose again, it's about you know, an avatar, and it's like a divine advantage. It's not like a mundane advantage that he's seeking in terms of like what his life ambitions are, or, you know, all these other things. Like, having an ashram of his own, none of nothing like worldly. There's a divine advantage and it's a divine condition. So it's not like an ordinary thing that you might have for, a respected family member or something like that, which is what I've always got in the back of my mind.
A hierarchical power structure or something. I mean, he actually says what the advantage is here as the disciple. That's his advantage, which is quite nice to think about, because the guru, whilst he's received him in a cold manner, let's say they have this unconditional love for each other. So the disciple is following the guru, and the guru then he has the responsibility. So in some way, I see exactly what it means, right? That the guru loves us unconditionally, and maybe we have these conditions. Maybe we're the imperfect version. The guru knows that. So, Mike.
Yeah, I'm not sure if obedience is really everything that is needed on the spiritual path. Guruji writes at times about spiritual egotism, about really having your own finding your own way to God and taking all the means possible. And that's what so Guruji was given a certain hand. And then we have to also remember that we are in this lucky position that God loves us and really wants us to come back, right? So all we need to do is play our cards the right way. And maybe that's an expression of that when he talks about it like that.
Yeah, I remember when you said that, Mike. I just remember that talk from one of the talks where he says, one of the ministers said that you may be like walking towards God at a slow pace, but he's running towards you.
Yeah, and this is acknowledged really by Sri Yukteswar when he says you are of exacting disposition, and he is described as speaking with compassionate finality when he says, "Let your wish be my wish." And so those, if any words so far have been music to Gurji's ears, that would have been it. We're going to jump into a bit more detail, but Mike, come to you first.
Is there a more technical way to say this? You're of exacting disposition. It's so funny, but it's great, and it's of course it's exactly what Guruji wants to hear, and then when he says let your wish be my wish, he doesn't say wish granted. He says we will work on this together, basically.
Yeah, you're right. Very technical, technocrat. But I thought that it was a fantastic response of Sri Yukteswar, which on the one hand acknowledges Mukunda's zeal as something that is to be admired, and for other disciples in his ashram to be looked up to and perhaps emulated, and obviously that applies for us as well. You shouldn't be shy to speak to God and gurus about virtually every single aspect of your life, let alone this noble and most divine aspiration that Guruji is talking about here to Sri Yukteswar. But also, and on the hand, he like succumbs to his wish really gracefully. He doesn't just like give up as someone may and just like sigh and go, okay, or he doesn't break down emotionally. He very gracefully and tactfully answers it as you'd expect a Gnana avatar response to be. And he certainly fulfills that in these two fantastic lines. You are of exacting disposition. Let your wish be my wish. And and he said it's compassionate as well, rang out with a compassionate finality, which is a really excellent description, isn't it, of those two lines.
Yeah, and we're going to see throughout this chapter many instances where Sri Yukteswar is interacting with other people, devotees, other lay people off the street, people that come to him for blessings and advice and so on. And he's very happy to withhold his speech, to be silent. He's very content, and very controlled in his speech. So he has obviously heard and covered exactly what he felt was needed in this conversation to then get to this point, because he would have cut it off at any point before. You know, he would have, he's in control himself, Sri Yukteswar, and Yogananda. So it is, you know, coming with finality, as Yogananda says here. It is definitely with purpose. And Yogananda's response was, a lifelong shadow lifted from my heart. The vague search hither and yon was over. I had found eternal shelter in a true guru. So that's kind of closing that chapter in his life, in some sense, that the search is done. You know, I've heard, I found my guru. I've heard exactly what I need to hear. Greg.
Exactly right, Chris. And the shadow, you know, the kind of shadow that presaged this second meeting from the first meeting, where it ended not harmoniously, is definitely lifted now. It's definitely gone, along with his search being over as well. So they kind of two happen at the same time. But if you'll recall that when in their first meeting, after Mukunda saw Sri Yukteswar, he said, you know, Guru Deva was, he recognized that face in the thousand visions that he had seen. And then he said that those eyes had, you know, often peered through the gloom of my nocturnal reveries, holding a promise I had not fully understood. And now we, I think, Mukunda understands the promise, because Sri Yukteswar then has now fulfilled that promise of that deepest longing of Mukunda for him to reveal God. And now essentially Sri Yukteswar is fulfilling that promise and making his own pledge to make it come true. So I think there's a nice arc from two chapters ago of that promise, not that he hadn't fully understood, to now it playing out and it being essentially a sure thing, if ever there was such a thing.
Yeah. And made all the more sweet by this verbal tussle that they've just had. Mm. Whatever conversation, whatever topics exactly that they covered in that, is making this all the more sweet for Mukunda, no doubt. And really, there are many quotes that we could go into that Paramahansa Yogananda said on the relationship of a guru. We have two short ones. Mike, maybe you can read out the first one and Priyank the second, and we'll look at seeing what Guruji thinks about the relationship between the devotee and the guru.
A true guru is ever living, even when no longer residing in a physical body. Through his oneness with God's omnipresence and omniscience, a true guru is always aware of the disciple and watches over him or her with constant love and protection.
I never found complete satisfaction, comfort, and God contact until I attuned myself with unconditional loyalty and devotion of the divine consciousness of my guru.
And so with that, then Sri Yukteswar says, I'll show you my hermitage. And he says, come with me, I'll show you my hermitage. And then he rose from a tiger mat, and glancing around Paramahansa Yogananda at the time, he noticed on the wall a pitcher that was garlanded with a spray of jasmine. Now we'll pause there before jump into the next line of astonishment that Yogananda had as to what was on the wall. Initially I thought, wow, why a tiger mat? You know, why is Sri Yukteswar sitting on a tiger mat? And Priyank, maybe you have some knowledge to share with us.
Yeah, so the reason why you raised your eyebrows, because in this present day, you know, and I suppose in the past, about ahimsa, non-violence, and, you know, the perceived cruelty of hunting animals for their fur and all that kind of stuff. These kind of things don't sit well with us, especially now. But you can imagine, I don't imagine Sri Yukteswar would have gone out and bought such a thing. But I can imagine that some Maharaja may have gifted it to him, and he is not one not to use something that may be beneficial, right? So some materials such as like wool or silk have this like insulating property, and no doubt a tiger skin or a skin of any animal, really, one not necessarily as pretty as, need not be as pretty as a, you know, a tiger skin, but anything that's that in that kind of organic creation would have that, serves that purpose. So, you know, we're told to sit in, you know, our meditation should have a seat, should have a you know, a insulating blanket, woolen blanket that drapes over and under our feet. So when we're practicing our techniques of meditation, we're kind of insulated ourselves, and we can not be disturbed, I suppose, in our meditations from all the gross things that the environment may distract us. So that's that. So I think that's potentially why he would have had it, and why he would have not been shy to use it. But being the Lion of Bengal, as Mukunda later describes him, you'd expect him to have a lion skin, but I suppose that's not as, doesn't sound as good, does it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but fierce nonetheless.
Mm.
And so we have revealed the picture on the wall in the next sentence by Amasa Yogananda saying, "It is Lahiri Mahashaya," he exclaimed, he said in astonishment. And Sri Yukteswar simply says, "Yes, my divine guru." And his tone, as Yogananda describes, was reverently vibrant. And this line was, I don't know how to describe it, but it, I mean, it is just such an homage to Lahiri Mahashaya from somebody so great as Sri Yukteswar. It kind of blew me away, but he said, "Greater he was as man and yogi than any other teacher whose life came within the range of my investigations." So he does not simply say, you know, he was my guru. That is a statement and a half, because Sri Yukteswar was a well-studied man, wasn't he? Extremely well-studied. So he would have known many sages, many great saints. But here he is saying that Lahiri Mahashaya was better than any other teacher whose life came within his range of his investigations, Mike.
Yeah, now one could say, what an incredible coincidence, or see that divine guidance that's going on here, that Guruji has grown up in a household where he saw Lahiri Mahashaya's picture every day as his family guru. And now he's again in a household where he sees Lahiri Mahashaya's picture every day. And the significance is huge, I think. And I don't know, I wanted to ask you guys a question, because I noticed that a few times when I go to someone's house and I don't know them. And it happened to me in India a few times that I visited people and they were not Yogananda devotees, but then I saw a picture of Lahiri Mahashaya. And suddenly I felt more at home in this home, even though I didn't know those people. But somehow it gave me a feeling of, this is a good place, I belong here. Did you ever feel that?
Yeah. Lahiri Mahashaya's picture appears quite widely, doesn't it? And part of it must be the mystery surrounding the miraculous impact of his image to Mukunda, you know, when he was a child, like when he was going through that, you know, Asiatic cholera, and mother told him to, you know, look intently at that very picture and chant, you know, Lahiri Mahashaya, Lahiri Mahashaya, and he was instantly healed. So, in Mejda, I think he says he used to scare away ghosts or whatever just by brandishing that picture. So it must be a powerful picture. And yeah, Mike, you're right. I've seen it in various different places, from people that aren't necessarily devotees and temples that aren't necessarily temples dedicated to anyone from our lineage. And that also Mahavatar Babaji's as well, more so than any of the others from our lineage. So much so now that when I went to India recently, I had to also purchase that picture. So now I've got that picture in my living room, and I wanted to put it near like the front door of my house, but my wife wasn't having it, so I think I still need to slowly twist her arm on that one. Maybe remind her of all these fantastic stories from that picture. The other thing I was going to say was the odds of, if we're not going to believe in fate and all that kind of stuff, which I know we do, the odds of Sri Yukteswar's guru being Lahiri Mahashaya and the family guru being Lahiri Mahashaya are quite slim. Now, Lahiri Mahashaya wasn't a Ramakrishna Paramahansa that would had renown, because he was, Ramakrishna was essentially Divine Mother was taking life essentially in front of people's eyes. So you can imagine the kind of press that he would have got, and hence how famous he was around the whole of India, and how important he was for the renaissance of Hinduism, really, actually. But Lahiri Mahashaya was not in that category. He was, he had his home is absolutely, if you've been there, it's tiny, it's in a very inconspicuous lane, and there's thousands of saints that have got, in Varanasi, where his home is, that have got legends similar to him, and across India. So the odds are quite slim that they should have the same guru. So it makes it his surprise. It actually gives it some context that he should be surprised, because of the likelihood of that. And also, he Sri Yukteswar's description, i.e. greater he was than as man and a yogi than any teacher whose life came within the range of my investigations. We read from, and I'm going to read a section later from the book, Swami Satyananda's book on the life of four, the biography of four Kriya Yoga masters, of which Lahiri Mahashaya is one. So he's written a biography about him. And Swami Satyananda is Mukunda's childhood friend, who is the first principal, second principal, I would say, of the Ranchi school whilst Guruji was in the US. He wrote a biography about him. And in there's I've got a reading from that, and but later that one of those four biographies is also about Sri Yukteswar. And if you read his biography, Sri Yukteswar went through lots of searching before he settled on Lahiri Mahashaya. Like he would literally debate swamis and gurus and see if their worth was what reputation. What their reputation was. So when he says, my search, great, all the whose life came within the range of my investigations, you can be assured that he didn't just settle, shall we say. He did a lot of searching. And this line that he said that he was so great, it echoes Swami Pranavananda's line in the earlier chapter, where he says, Lahiri Mahashaya was the greatest yogi I ever knew. He was divinity itself in the form of flesh. So these are two disciples of Lahiri Mahashaya, and they've got quite a similar description for him, haven't they? Equally beautiful, you might say.
Yes. How many times does it do you need to hear it until it becomes a trend? Only one, maybe. And this picture with Lahiri Mahashaya, it had a spray of jasmine. And jasmine is a plant associated with Lord Shiva and holds a very special place in Vedic texts. And it's also meant to have a very calming effect on the mind, but depends on your Ayurvedic balance, of course.
Yeah, and principally it's offered to deities in temples of Lakshmi or Vishnu. And ladies in, especially in South India, they have this thing called a mugro, which is like a bunch of jasmine. And people that have smelt jasmine, they'll know how fragrant the actual flower is. You can, if it's in the room, the whole room, even just one small flower will just ignite the whole room with its beautiful fragrance. And so yeah, the South Indian women, they kind of tie their hair up in a bun, or they just let the jasmine drape down the side, and it's better than any fragrance that the West can produce, shall we say. It's just phenomenal. I've actually grown two different jasmine plants in my garden, so I'm hoping that was last year. I'm hoping to one day wake up to this fragrance one day.
Will
But
be
yeah, it's
reminded.
loved. It's a very beloved plant in India. And especially in the moonlight, I don't know, some mystical thing happens. If there's a moonlight bouncing off Jasmine, oh man, it's they kind of start glowing and the fragrance goes insane. I don't know if their listeners have experienced this, but yeah, it's quite nice.
Interesting, yeah. And the smell will then remind you of this scene when Mukunda bows silently before this picture, and this is a beautiful, beautiful line, and we'll end this episode on this line. He says, "Soul homage sped to the peerless master who, blessing my infancy, had guided my steps to this hour." So yeah, full circle, Priyanka.
Indeed. And you'll remember one of the Swamis just had a talk about this recently in India when I was there. He said, Lahiri Mahashaya, when he was called to Dwarahat, all the adjacent
Ranikid.
Ranikhet, that's
Yeah.
it, by his superintendent. And when his super the superintendent and resolved it to as a Babaji to meet Babaji because Babaji had planted this thought in that superintendent's mind to call Lahiri Mahashaya, even though he wasn't that wasn't we wasn't needed in any way, but his mind was obviously plastic enough to hear Babaji's suggestion. But the point was that here he says, the picture had and his blessings had guided his steps to this hour through all the disciples that he'd met. How many disciples of Lahiri Mahashaya had he met? Shastri Mahashaya, his parents, Swami Parinivananda, who I just mentioned, and now Sri Yukteswar. He all of these like led to this spot. And you'll also remember, so Lahiri Mahashaya was guided by Babaji through that superintendent, through that thought being planted, and the Swami that I mentioned when he was telling the story, he said, "Heaven only knows how many interjections our gurus have interceded with all the people in our lives to get us to where we are today, to appreciate the value of the teachings and the guru-disciple relationship that we have, but that we will never know. We just have to know in good faith that it's innumerable. But one day, of course, that the answer to that question will be revealed one fine sunny, glorious day."
Beautiful. And with that, gents, have we covered this part of chapter 12 sufficiently? Or have we anything else to add? No, covered sufficiently. Well, if there's anything else the listeners have to add into, feel free to join in the conversation. We'll be joined with Lauren in the next episode. Mike's leading, all being well. So we'll see you at next on the next episode. Thank you for joining us, Jai Guru.
Thank you.
Thank you.